Welcome to Thrivology Lab Podcast, where we explore the science, philosophy, and practice of thriving. Our goal is to help you create a happier and healthier life through education, application, and transformation. Your co-hosts on this journey are Phil Dunwoody, that's me.
And Neil Lutterbach, that's me. Phil and I are both on the faculty at Juniata College, where we teach courses to promote human thriving and well-being. Hi, Phil.
Hey, Neil.
Listeners, first of all, thank you for listening, for checking us out and sticking with us. If you didn't get a chance to listen to our part one of this nutritional section, we encourage you to do that first. So go check that out and then rejoin us. Today, we're going to look briefly, we're going to build on what we talked about in part one, and then we're going to lay out some of the evidence of how nutrition can affect mental health. We'll take a look at the role of the microbiome, and finally, we'll take a look at intermittent fasting and autophagy. And just as a couple disclaimers, we talked about this in part one, but also to remind folks that this podcast is for informational purposes. And before you make any significant change to your diet or lifestyle, make sure you check with a doctor, particularly if you're under care right now. And it's also, I think, Phil and I talk about this a lot, that you know we're approaching thriving as a system. And even though we're sort of academically calling attention to here nutrition, it's interacting with our sleep and our sleep with our movement and our movement with our relationships. And all of these things are all interconnected, as we talked about in our mindfulness section. Part of what mindfulness reminds us is that everything's connected. So we're not saying that I think just changing one thing is going to have, you know, it's going to be your panacea or cure-all, but it could have significant impacts.
Well, and actually, yeah, that's a great point, right? The things we select as topics for this podcast, the research shows they do have significant impacts. But to your point, they don't stand alone. If I get I get a good night's sleep, mm-hmm. I eat healthy, I have a mindfulness practice, all of these things contribute to kind of my resilience and thriving. And then just to like to reiterate that point about this is not medical advice, especially in this episode, because I'm going to talk a lot about this area of nutritional psychiatry. And so it's really, you know, kind of it's the relationship between diet and mental health. And so you do want to kind of discuss any changes that you might make in diet to deal with mental health issues. You know, if you're seeing a healthcare professional, psychiatrist, psychologist, we would encourage you to talk to them. And if you're not, but need to, we would encourage you to do that as well.
Well, Phil, you bring up sort of nutritional psychiatry. Can you sort of lay out that emerging field, that landscape for us?
I'll first say that researching for this episode, even though I've already been interested in, I mean, I've spent a lot of time thinking about my diet, mental health. I've been aware of research on the gut-brain connection, which we're going to talk a lot about in here. We talked about it some in the mindfulness episode. We talk about vagus nerve activation and sympathetic, parasympathetic nervous system responses. Still, researching this episode blew my mind because this is all relatively new stuff, frankly. This area of nutritional psychiatry is new. And the area about gut microbiome and how it affects the brain is new. And so nutritional psychiatry, generally speaking, is the treatment of mental health dysfunction or disorders through diet or other things related to diet, right, that we're going to talk about. Now, not just diet, right? The psychiatrist would also say that it's not diet only, but the toolbox. So psychiatrists will tell you that the toolbox they have helps with things like depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, etc., but not nearly as much as they would like. Right. And people who live with these things know this. You know, you have a medication that maybe it works okay. At some point you're not sure if it's working. You switch medications. There really is this trial and error and in a way a frustration that there aren't better tools. And what is emerging as an incredibly important tool in that toolbox of kind of psychotherapy, you know, which is just some type of talk therapy. Medicines, you know, kind of prescription medicines, you know, SSRIs, for example, in that category. And then this other diet. Diet is a huge component now. And this is the whole nutritional psychiatry movement is really doing this food first. Basically, when if you go to a psychiatrist who is doing this work, in their first session with you, yeah, they're going to ask you how you're doing and how you're feeling and some lifestyle things. They're going to ask you a lot of questions about your diet. And one of the main things they're going to do right away is to see if there are places they can tweak your diet to improve brain health.
But I think that, you know, what I hear you calling attention to is this sort of bi-directional system. And I think nutritional psychiatry under the larger umbrella of the emerging field of functional medicine of looking at root causes. So it's not,
yes.
So yes, they're using nutrition as a treatment, but also looking at what are the root causes of these things as well, and not just symptomatically treating, which conventional medicine is largely attending to, sort of symptomatic, but really getting at what's the cause of this.
Yeah, and I think that is what a number of really famous kind of prominent members in nutritional psychiatry are arguing, that for example, the medications they've been using are, some of them would argue, those are treating symptoms that are actually metabolic dysfunctions that can be at least largely corrected, sometimes fully corrected, through diet changes. And that's
remarkable.
It's really remarkable. Yeah. It really is. And so we're going to cover some of the research, because that's a big claim, right? And you know, when you hear big claims, frankly, you should be skeptical.
Sure.
I am. but reading through this literature, that's why I said it really blew my mind. We've already kind of accepted that if you have, let's say, cardiovascular issues, you have high blood pressure, you have high cholesterol, that, geez, you should change your diet, right? You should exercise, you change your diet, sleeping habits, right? These are all things that are going to
stress.
Right, reduce your stress. The connection with diet and physical health is clear and well accepted in the medical community as practice. Now, you and I would argue maybe that should be more forward, right? I think, but it is a pretty accepted norm. The idea that diet should be one of the first tools to treat mental health is a relatively new idea in kind of established medicine, right? So you can trace ideas of that food as medicine that go way back, right? So it's not a new idea, but as a practice in modern medicine, most medical doctors will tell you they have almost no training in nutrition. I mean, I heard one say, for example, that in medical school, they had like 2 or 3 hours maybe of nutrition training in their whole program. And this includes people who are psychiatrists, right? Who are going on to treat kind of mental health issues. So what the nutritional psychiatry movement is arguing is that in the same way that we think of diet and heart health, we need to be thinking about diet and brain health, because brain health is mental health, right? We tend to talk about mental health, mental illness, whatever terms you want to use, as somehow not physical, but it's actually brain health.
But we can, not to get overly academic about this, but we can trace this sort of schism between brain and body back to Rene Descartes,
right?
As a philosopher saying that, like, these are different things. I'm going to talk about them as different. And we've lived with this idea that the body is one thing and this mind stuff is another. But cognitive and neuroscience is constantly reminding us it's one thing, one system, and changes to one affect the whole system.
Yeah, this is in my, you know, as a psychologist teaching in a college, one of the things I try and message to my students all the time, especially if it's like an intro class, is that we tend to, sometimes we ask questions or we say things like, well, is this real or is it just in your head? Right? Like, and what we mean is it physiological,
right,
or is it just in your head?
And what I'm trying,
And what I try and get people to realize, everything that happens, quote, in your head is a biological reaction. So yes, we can talk about the phenomenology of feeling depressed or feeling anxious or feeling happy. Those are all biochemical changes that have to do with neurotransmitters and different areas of your brain being more active or less active. So
and then once we get into, like, talk about the gut microbiome, like, are these thoughts even mine? Or are they a bunch of critters?
Yeah, exactly. Right. So there's a story that, One, let me find it here. Dr. Chris Palmer talks about, he's on the faculty at Harvard. He's in this kind of nutritional psychiatry movement. And he had a student he'd been treating with schizophrenia for 8 years. Schizophrenia is very hard to manage. Yes, we have medications for it. They help control the symptoms. They often don't fully go away, right? So it's a very difficult disorder to treat. This particular patient, the way he tells the story, this particular patient had gained a lot of weight. Sometimes that is a side effect of medications, and wanted to lose weight. And so Chris Palmer recommended a ketogenic diet, which is something that kind of goes way back historically, to help lose weight. And the patient, over a pretty short period of time of adhering to this diet, started to say things to him like, you know, those voices in my head I've been hearing, I don't think they're real, you know. And this was, you know, someone you've been treating for years, right?
Nearly a decade.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the way he tells the story, he was really surprised at how well this patient seemed to suddenly be doing, like genuinely shocked. And he wasn't the only person in this patient's care team. So he went to the person's dad, right? And he went to a psychologist that also worked and said, like, I'm seeing some big changes in this person, and they're doing really well. Are you seeing them too? And they were like, yes, what's happening? And he's like, I don't know, but we've recently, you know, we've done a diet change with him. And these results are shocking, right? So this is, I'll say, a story, and we love stories, right? They tell good, and I think they give us clues to say, well, okay, do we have more data for this? Because a particular story, you don't know. Maybe that the symptoms just coincidentally were going away for some other reason. And so this is what we're going to kind of talk about, is what do we know about kind of the relationship of diet as a causal factor to impact mental health. And there are essentially like three criteria for causation that we talk about in basically any science. So one is correlation, right? We've all heard that phrase, correlation does not mean causation, right? And that's true, but correlation is one of the criteria, right? If diet and depression, for example, weren't correlated, there'd be no reason to look and ask whether or not they're causally related.
And can you give like just a definition of correlation? Like what do you mean by correlation?
Yeah, yeah. Correlation is, I guess that's probably the statistical term generally to say that two things co-vary. So if, for example, in depression, we see that the more ultra-processed foods you eat, the higher your risk of developing depression. And the more you stick to a Mediterranean diet, which we're going to talk about in this issue, the more likely you are to not have depression. That's kind of an inverse association. So it's two things that change together. One may go up, and if the other one goes up with it, we call that a positive association. If one goes up and the other goes down, that we call that a negative association. So it's a positive association between ultra-processed foods and depression. You know, as one goes up, the other goes up. There's a negative association between adherence to a Mediterranean diet and depression. As your adherence to a Mediterranean diet goes up, your likelihood of your depression symptoms actually go down. So that's correlation. So the other second criteria is called temporal precedence, which means that one thing causes another. If you say A causes B, A has to happen first in time. Like unless... Right, you're Michael J. Fox with a DeLorean, or Doctor Who with a TARDIS. You can't go back in time and cause things to happen in the future. That is kind of common sense in a way, right? But often when things are correlated, we don't know that, right? So let's say we see a correlation between diet and mental health. Well, which one came first? In correlational data, you often can't tell. And then the last criteria is what we call internal validity or elimination of other plausible alternatives. This is to say, can we control for other variables that might be explaining the relationship, right? So again, if you think of diet and mental health, well, we know that, again, the more you eat ultra-processed foods, the more likely you are to be depressed. But it's also true that you're also less likely to exercise, right? So that you have a bunch of things that tend to be correlated together. So maybe it's not the food. Maybe it has nothing to do with diet, right? Maybe it's something else. So this is This is why we do, this is why we like randomized clinical studies, because they allow that experimental control. They're the best thing. We can get correlational evidence through epidemiological research. Causal evidence we tend to get through clinical randomized control studies.
But I think that's also to the, you know, the listeners, I think this is also why it's so hard to study nutrition, because nutrition is relatively subtle. I take a pill, maybe almost immediately I have an effect. There's much greater sense of causation there. I've done this thing and then I take ibuprofen, the headache goes away or whatever. I think that, but you know, improving my nutrition, that those changes are often subtle and it's harder because of the complexity to pinpoint exactly what's happening.
Yeah. And, you know, imagine doing an experiment where you get randomly assigned to different dietary conditions and you have to adhere to them for months. Well, that's a very difficult research project to actually do, right? How do you get people to do that? You can do it with rats, much easier. And we do. Right? A lot of the research is on animal models.
And often we talk about sort of metabolic ward studies as the sort of gold standard of nutrition studies, where I have the subjects confined to a ward situation and I can absolutely control, because we don't know in the wild if the person's adhering to the thing they say. There are difficulties to studying.
Absolutely. Stuff. Absolutely. So the first question we ask is kind of like, Do we have correlational evidence that these things are related, right? So this is from an article called Nutritional Medicine as Mainstream in Psychiatry. This is a 2015 article published in The Lancet, and I'm just going to read a short quote here. Although the determinants of mental health are complex, the emerging and compelling evidence for nutrition as a crucial factor in the high prevalence and incidence of mental disorders suggests that diet is as important to psychiatry as it is to cardiology, endocrinology, and gastroenterology. Right. So again, the thing that's we have these ideas that diet are important for these other things that are related to our body. Guess what? Our brain is part of our body, and we should think of brain health in the same way.
Yeah. Right? And I imagine just like we look at smoking, and it took us a very long time to recognize that smoking was bad. Now it's common knowledge.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I imagine in 5 years, this conversation will be as evident as, you know, the ills of, say, ultra-processed foods will be as taboo, as pushed back against as tobacco.
That's my hope. That's very optimistic of you. I like that. But if you also kind of study the history of how that change happened, there was widespread knowledge in the scientific community that smoking was bad for your health. And way before there was widespread knowledge in the general public, and as the scientific community tried to message out to the public, the tobacco lobby waged a very effective misinformation and disinformation campaign to mislead the public, right? Because they were making lots of money. And of course, they helped make generous contributions to political campaigns to prevent regulation. And so, you know, think about how large the food industry is and how much money is involved. And so it's hard to regulate an industry with that much power and money, frankly. But I like your optimism, Neil. So let's talk about the correlational evidence first, right? So there's what's called the Sun Studies. This comes out of a Spanish large kind of cohort study. This has been ongoing since 1999. There's something like 15,000 participants at this point. So this is basically people every 2 years or so, they fill out surveys about their diet and their health. And so kind of over really long periods of time, they can track changes in diet, changes in health. And there's not just one study related to the Sun Studies, and that refers to a university. So you can find actually a lot of research that comes out of this, and we'll link to it in the show notes. But I'm just going to read, again, kind of a quote from one of the studies, quote, higher adherence to the Mediterranean dietary pattern may be inversely associated with mortality, type 2 diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. Likewise, a link with mental health outcomes such as depressive symptoms, cognitive status, and quality of life was also found, suggesting its benefits, its beneficial effects toward brain health. So, you have this, again, we talk association, right? So as adherence to a Mediterranean diet goes up, mortality goes down. You live longer. Type 2 diabetes goes down. Cardiovascular disease goes down, right? And so we've the Mediterranean diet gets all this kind of rage and hype. When you look at the research, it pops up over and over again as incredibly well researched and validated. So it's not just a fad thing.
Yeah.
There's a ton of research. Now, this is correlational research, right? So again, getting that, like, well, is it really causal?
For those playing along at home, you've heard us now mention two sort of big, and they're in sort of the fad conversation, sort of ketogenic diet, Mediterranean mm-hmm. diet. We'll talk a little bit more about the nuts and bolts of that, but also some of the commonalities that might be there as well. And as we think about, like, how to implement some of this in your life.
So we real quickly unpack each of those briefly?
Sure.
Right? Yeah. You want to do ketogenic?
Yeah. So ketogenic diet really came to prominence about 100 years ago as a treatment for epilepsy. And now it has come to sort of fad, sort of cultural prominence because principally sort of weight loss, because it's a high fat, moderate protein, low or sometimes extremely low and carbohydrate. And by low, we're talking sub 50 grams of carbohydrate a day. And one of the mechanisms that carbohydrates are principally doing are sort of activating insulin. And so what we see with type 2 diabetes and pre-diabetes, obesity is partially a insulin resistance. So the mechanisms of the body, the receptor sites don't, you need more insulin to get to shuttle the sugars out of the blood. So we've used it medically for a very long time, and now we're seeing other uses of that diet as well. There are upsides, downsides for just sort of normal people using it. A lot of it will depend on
it's a difficult diet to mm-hmm. adhere to.
And really, if you're really following a ketogenic diet, you really should check your ketone levels, which is what your body runs on, basically two fuel systems. By default, glucose, that's where you're getting from carbohydrates. When you're not getting enough carbohydrates, it switches over to these ketones, which is using fat as a fuel source. So sometimes when people are trying to just do ketogenic diets on their own, they're not monitoring actually their ketone levels. So really, they're just very low carb, but they're not getting into ketosis. So they're just getting a lot of the negatives, sort of the sluggishness or not really fully into ketosis. So
fascinating. The first
fascinating
documented evidence of a ketogenic diet in medicine dates to 500 BC to treat epilepsy. It's that old, right? Yeah.
Newer,
right.
Yeah.
It then kind of resurfaced. And, you know, now we have kind of medications for epilepsy, but it is still used for some people who may not be responsive to the medications. You always have some people who are treatment resistant to certain medications. But yeah, fascinating. And Dr. Chris Palmer, who I mentioned earlier, he really views the ketogenic diet as a way to kind of, it's almost like a physical reboot of your whole metabolism. Mm-hmm. And so when he has patients with kind of unresolved mental health disorders that are not effectively being treated other ways, what one of his go-tos, frankly, is a ketogenic diet as a reset. And he says that may not be a long-term thing because it is a difficult diet to adhere to, but that essentially he views brain dysfunction as metabolic dysfunction, that you have some areas of your brain, for example, the threat system being overactive and under areas of your brain being underactive. And the metabolic reset kind of helps all areas of your brain essentially get the energy that they need. And so he views, personally discusses a lot of mental health as really kind of metabolic dysfunction, which is kind of a fascinating.
But I think that I like that idea of a reset, because I think even if you, like, I don't have a lot of mental health issues, I don't have a lot of metabolic issues, doing a kind of metabolic reset using something like a ketogenic diet can be really advantageous to getting to what we call metabolic flexibility. Your ability to go in and out of different glucose or a ketone system for fuel. Ancestrally, our hunter-gatherer ancestors had to do that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
sometimes, you know, you've got a harvest and there's lots of fruits and vegetables. Well, I can use a lot of carbs. Then I'm in the winter and I'm just doing principally meats, right? So you're having to use different systems, which is an elegant evolutionary advantage to being human, that we can switch in and out of these systems. And deliberately practicing those kinds of systems keeps your body in that sort of flexible state. You want to talk about Mediterranean?
Yeah, briefly, right? Because you can find tons about this online, right? The Mediterranean diet is really comes out of looking at people in Mediterranean regions who have unusually long lifespans, right? The kind of some of the blue zone research we've talked about already in this show. And it's a diet that is high in fruits and vegetables, whole grains, healthy fat. So instead of like low fat, it's like, no, olive oil, soak it up. Like basically put olive oil and nuts on everything, and fish and seafood. All of these things provide really essential nutrients for brain health. Some moderate amount of dairy, and then kind of a generous use of herbs and spices in place of salt. So I'm not going to go into a whole, but again, you can look up a Mediterranean diet and get lots of details. But okay, so we have, and there's research supporting both this ketogenic and Mediterranean diet to address mental health. It seems like much more of the research focuses on the Mediterranean diet, and my guess is because that's just easier to adhere to. If you're trying to do an intervention, asking people to eat more Mediterranean diet like is easier than asking people to eat more ketogenic like. It's a less stringent, less strict diet. So we have this correlational research, right? So let's go to the other kind of two criteria, are kind of this temporal precedence and elimination of plausible alternatives, like good internal validity. Well, you get this through experiments where you randomly assign people to conditions. By randomly assigning people to conditions, they're essentially equal to start with on everything. So the first randomized control study to look at diet and its impact on nutrition is known as the SMILES trials. It was published in 2017. I said this is a new field, right? So 2017 is not that old. SMILES is an acronym supporting the modification of lifestyle in lowered emotional states, right? So in other words, can you improve emotional state through diet? Okay. All participants had moderate or severe depression in this study. And that's something. Severe depression, I mean, you're not walking around going to work with severe depression, right? Mild depression, sure, but not severe depression. Participants were also included. One of the other kind of criteria for inclusion was that they had a poor diet, right? So they had depressive symptoms at moderate or high levels, and low on a dietary health scale. And they, you know, quote, participants had to report a poor, low intake of dietary fiber, lean proteins, fruits and vegetables, and a high intake of sweets, processed meats, and salty snacks. So there's a lot of what you and I already talked about, right?
Right.
They had a lot of ultra-processed foods, and they didn't have much in the way of kind of whole unprocessed foods, and they were doing something very different than the Mediterranean diet. So this was a 12-week study, including 7 home visits, and participants were randomly assigned into 2 groups. One was the nutrition group, and they got pretty basic instructions, you know, kind of the 7 home visits kind of helped them, did some meal planning, discuss diet, and basically encouraged them to eat some whole grains, vegetables, fruits, you know, again, this unprocessed healthy foods, use of olive oil, and the control condition. So if you were randomly assigned to the control condition, you got the same number of visits with what they refer to as a befriending protocol. In other words, someone just came and talked to you, because we know that part of depression is loneliness. And just there's a good bit of evidence in talk therapy that just talking to someone on a regular basis is healthy. It doesn't matter what, you know, what it's about. So this was the control group. All participants were encouraged to continue with whatever psychotherapy or medications they were already on. So they weren't trying to replace any treatments with this. And the dietary support group, that group, showed significant decreases in depression scores compared to the befriending kind of control group. with what we call a large effect size. To say it's a large effect size, you can find real differences between things that are very small. So, or you can find real differences that are very large, right? So the fact that if it's real or not is independent on how big of an effect it is, okay? So the amazing part about this study is full what we call depression remission, which means scores on depression scale drop so low that these people would no longer be considered clinically depressed. 32% of the participants in the diet group showed full remission over that 12-week period. Now, 8% in the other group did, right? So now maybe that's just because of company, right?
Right.
Or maybe it would have happened anyway, but that's why you have a control, right? 32%, Neil, there's nothing, there's no medication we can give for depression that works that well.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Full remission, right?
In 12 weeks. Like 12 weeks. That's a snapshot. Like that's so relatively soon.
It's astonishing.
Just think, if you're suffering, you could do something today to start yourself on a journey to improve your well-being. That's phenomenal.
Yes, it really is, right? And so this is one study. I'll say one experiment, right? So again, part of the skepticism in science is to say, we want to see replication. We don't want to just see one study. We want to see other labs trying to do the same thing and see, do they have the same findings? So after that, there were kind of a number of studies that came out, and meta-analysis is basically like a study of studies. So you take all the published randomized control studies that are out there and you say, kind of overall, if we look at all of these, what do we see, right? Is it that it works in one study and not in the other? When we average it all out, it turns out it doesn't actually work. Well, no, actually the meta-analyses really support the SMILES trials, the experiment. So a 2019 meta-analysis with over kind of 45,000 participants across the essentially 16 eligible studies that were included showed that dietary intervention significantly reduced depression symptoms. This particular study didn't show a main effect on anxiety, unfortunately.
And that's another reminder, like a meta-analysis has a set of studies they're looking at. They're not looking at all studies, right? So you
have,
could do it.
Inclusion criteria essentially, right? So for example, this meta-analysis, it's only looking at randomized control studies on this topic. I think that we're also in English. I think that was one of the, probably because the author's language limits. Some research does show a dietary impact on anxiety, for sure, to be clear, but some does not. And so that there's a abundantly clear connection with depression. It's not quite as strong with anxiety.
Just as, we're principally focusing on sort of depression and anxiety, partially because of there's just prevalence.
They're the two most common.
But yep. We're seeing, we're not going into detail today on this, but research is coming out regarding nutrition and things like PTSD, OCD,
schizophrenia,
ADHD, schizophrenia.
Psychosis.
When you start looking at the landscape of this, it's pervasive and it's ubiquitous. Like this could be profound.
Well, and part of what the nutritional psychiatry movement argues is that if you look at, let's just pick any one of those mental health disorders you just listed, when you get diagnosed with one, your odds of being diagnosed with another increase dramatically, right? So what we see is this kind of comorbidity, this co-occurrence. So what some people argue is, well, this points actually, these are not separate dysfunctions, right? The different labels are labeling how they display symptomatically, but that there is some underlying cause, and that underlying cause might be dietary related and causing problems with your microbiome, which is probably a good transition to what is the microbiome?
That's a great transition. So what is it? Yeah, the microbiome is this ecosystem. You have it in your digestive system. It contains millions of bacteria, fungi, viruses, mouth to rectum. It's the whole inside. But you also have a microbiome on your skin, which is, we don't think about the skin as being sort of a digestive system, but the stuff we put on our skin filtered into other parts of our body as well.
Are you saying all bacteria isn't bad, Neil?
Right.
I mean, I say that jokingly, right? But in a way, like, that's totally how I was brought up.
Totally. Yeah.
All bacteria are bad. You want to cleanse your body of them, right?
Well, think
so
about,
I get
like,
sick, I take an antibiotic, or I use antibiotic soap or whatever.
Right. Well, yeah, the antibiotics, we live in this sort of ultra clean society. I mean, every desk has a hand sanitizer on it, and that's not, you know, it's not being discriminatory. Like, it's killing everything, right? Same with like the antibiotics. It's just, it's sometimes not to sort of villainize antibiotics. They're incredible, fantastic, amazing tools, but the sort of chronic, often chronic use of them can, in some cases, irreparably damage the microbiome, and sometimes it just can't recover certain species from that. But yeah, it's all the critters that live in and are co-evolved with us to help us survive. And so Phil brought up in previous podcasts, the mental health is also mediated partly by this sort of vagus nerve. So your vagus nerve, 10th cranial nerve, it's wandering through the body, connecting to all these organs, and it's this communication highway between your brain and different systems. And your gut microbiome is using that Ethernet system to also send signals of hunger, of feeling states, of all kinds of things. 70% of our immune system is in the gut. So, you know, if you say, like, how do I know if I have a healthy gut? If you are prone to getting sick often, it's probably a gut problem.
If you have digestive issues frequently, right? Inflammation issues.
Brain fog, if you feel fatigued all the time. So we talked about...
I mentioned in the last episode that I had issues with gluten and cut out gluten, right? And oh my gosh, it got to this, you know, as I was cutting out and then experimenting, putting it back in to see what would happen. My stomach would hurt. I would have, you know, essentially diarrhea. But honestly, the worst part was that I couldn't think straight. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would feel exhausted and totally lethargic, and brain fog is a great descriptive term. And it would last a day. It would last sometimes 24 hours. I would be wiped out.
Well, that's like, we often think like, I'm eating food for me, but I'm eating food for this ecosystem. I'm literally feeding this biome, this entire world within me. And that world is trying to keep me alive because we have this symbiotic relationship. And so, you know, we can think about like prebiotics and probiotics have become very popular as supplements. And I think just as, again, we don't want to be prescriptive on this podcast, but I think we would argue supplements are exactly that word. They are supplemental. They shouldn't form the basis of your protocol, whatever that is. But just to sort of give some definitions and some examples, prebiotics, that's the food that is particularly advantageous, or, you know, we can think about them as disadvantageous foods for the gut, but prebiotics that are promoting good gut health, things like whole grains, bananas, artichokes. Probiotics are foods that actually contain live organisms that help populate that system. So things like yogurt, sauerkraut, kimchi, any of your fermented foods are particularly good. And you don't even need that much of them. I'm not a huge fan of the taste of sauerkraut, but I know it's really good. So even like a spoonful of sauerkraut can do wonders.
You know, that was one of my... doing this episode, I bought some kimchi.
Yeah.
Because one of my take-homes was like, you know, I'm not eating enough fermented foods.
Totally. Same.
Right?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So like, I don't need to eat much, but I should have a little bit in my diet daily.
Yeah.
It's like, okay,
yeah,
I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
Small change.
Yeah, small change. And even just having like a jar of just plain sauerkraut and just like, just take a spoonful of medicine and just like, just that's all you really, you know, if you enjoy it, by all means, like eat it up.
Yeah.
But you don't need all that much. Right. Yeah. But we talked about all these kinds of feeling state. Like you might feel achy, brain fog. You might get sick a lot. Dr. Robin Chutkan is an integrative gastroenterologist. Hard word.
Yeah, big words.
A lot of
syllables.
She says that 75% of people between the ages of 18 and 44 have some form of gut issues. That's incredible. And so, yeah, like if we think about the prevalence of these mental health issues, of these otherwise physical health issues like obesity, type 2 diabetes, and those comorbidities we're talking, like how mm-hmm. one's increasing, the likelihood of another increasing on the other side. We're talking about 75% of the population. And, she would, and I think we would point a lot of that to this sort of conspiratorial system of ultra-processed foods, sedentary lifestyle, overstressed, bad sleep. That's just a recipe for problems. So it's not just because stress can kill out dysregulate the microbiome, your sleep. We're going to talk about
stress shuts down your digestive system, right? It's one of the mindfulness episode we talked mm-hmm. about that your body stress response is a survival response. To deal with some kind of short-term emergency, right? This is an evolutionary response. And so when there's a stressor in your environment, your body essentially shuts down expensive systems. And by expensive, I mean they use a lot of energy. Digestion uses a huge amount of energy. And so it reduces blood flow to your gut, right? So if you're chronically stressed, you're not digesting your food. You're not actually absorbing the nutrients out of your food that your body, your brain needs, and your gut biome.
And, you know, no good conversation about the gut would be complete without talking about poop.
That's right.
Phil, you want to talk about sort of other interventions, particularly sort of fecal transplants?
Yeah. So this is, I remember when I first heard about this, and every time, you know, I talk about this with my students, they're like, what? Well, this is a thing? Yes, fecal microbiota transplant. It is what it sounds like. It is taking fecal matter and moving it essentially across people. This was done in rats first, right? Before you do this kind of thing on humans, before you can get approval for it, you actually have to show that it's effective in other animals. It's kind of, you know, part of the there's what we call IRBs that are responsible for essentially making sure researchers don't harm participants and look out for them. So a fecal transplant. Yeah. So again, this gets to the experimental evidence, right? Because this is a way in which you can take what would be an unhealthy microbiome and transplant it. And this is, they did this in rats first to other rats and say, well, if we take an unhealthy microbiome and we put some of that fecal matter in a healthy rat, we see the healthy rat become depressed. Right? That's fascinating. And so. So here's one on people. This was published in 2020, Effect of Fecal Microbiota Transplant on Symptoms of Psychiatric Disorders, a Systematic Review. So I'm just going to read a section of this. 21 studies met the eligibility criteria. That's a lot. And were analyzed for reported changes in mood and behavioral measures indicative of psychiatric well-being. All studies found a decrease in depressive and anxiety-like symptoms and behaviors resulting from the transplantation of healthy microbiota. The inverse was also found. The transmission of depressive and anxiety-like symptoms and behaviors resulting from the transplantation of microbiota from psychiatrically ill donors to healthy recipients. And last quote, there appears to be strong evidence for the treatment and transmission of psychiatric illness through FMT, this fecal microbiota transplant, right? So, you know, you can think we've been talking about diet, but okay, well, what's the mechanism? How does diet affect your brain? The answer seems to be your gut, right? Your gut microbiome, because you're like most of your neurotransmitters are actually made in your gut.
Yep.
And you will even hear some researchers refer to the gut as the second brain, you know, this kind of gut brain axis. We historically think of the brain as like where all this stuff happens, but increasingly we are appreciating how the brain is not a separate thing, right? That the gut brain axis, we should view it as one interconnected system. So if you can affect the gut health, you're going to affect the brain health positively or negatively.
We're almost out of time for today, but we're just going to ever so briefly, we could do a whole episode on the next topic, but just to sort of round out this conversation, briefly talking about metabolic autophagy and intermittent fasting. So we've talked about quantity, which is your caloric intake. We talked about quality, whole versus ultra-processed foods and that whole spectrum. The third component of our sort of nutritional thinking might be called timing. So that's sort of just the when, how often you eat, right? And so there's a great deal of research around the benefits of some sort of fasting protocol, and you're already doing it. People are like, I don't want to fast. I couldn't do that. You're already doing it. So we call the first meal of the day breakfast, break your fast. So if you're sleeping 8 hours, that's presumably you're not getting up in the middle of the night and walking to the fridge. You're not eating for that time. You break the fast, right? All fasting is arguing is like maybe we can increase that window. So maybe a couple hours even before dinner to take that 8 hours to 12 hours. Now I'm just eating in a 12-hour window and I'm not eating in a 12-hour window. And that couple hours, particularly before bed, if you want to experiment with this, you might notice your sleep quality, particularly if you measure your sleep through some sort of wearable device, you may notice incredible increases in all kinds of sort of biomarkers that are just sort of measurable that way. You might just feel better, right?
Yeah, and there's a good bit of research on that as well, right? And the short, it's a metabolic issue that right. Essentially digesting food takes an incredible amount of energy and blood. And that is blood that should be going to your brain at that point to essentially flush the brain of toxic chemicals. The short way to think of it, being awake causes a buildup of toxic chemicals in your brain. And when you sleep, there's a flushing process that happens. And if you eat before bed, you're disrupting that flushing process because all that energy has to go to your gut first.
But yeah, that digestion is the first task. Like if I have new food in my system, my body needs to process that such that it doesn't rot, which will cause all kinds of problems. So it has to digest it and get it out of that stomach, right? And to your point, there are a whole host of systems that are a whole host of activities happening during sleep, not exclusively during sleep, but one of them, similar to that flushing, is this process of metabolic autophagy. And autophagy is a fancy word, autophagy, self-eating. It's just the body's way of consuming and getting rid of broken, dead cells to get them out of using those up as energy to sort of clean house. Taking out the trash, exactly. I remember back in the day, I don't know if computers still have to do this. I'm about to show my ignorance. I remember it used to have to defrag.
The hard drive.
I always think of, and don't come at me, computer scientists. The analogy may not be totally right, but I always thought about autophagy as sort of a defragging. I'm trying to all these broken cells or broken files in my body need to get flushed out, eaten up, discarded. And that's part of that sort of healing.
It requires energy to do that.
It requires energy. Yep. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. So why don't we talk about some heuristics? Yeah. What are some general rules of thumb that I might use?
Yeah, so I think, and this is for the person who's I'm just starting out on this journey, maybe. I like to think of cut one, add one. So thinking about I have to make a whole change to my whole dietary system, that seems daunting. And I've got to exercise, and I've got to sleep better, I've got to do all these things. If you try to cut or swap one thing. So maybe you're
one small change at a time.
So cut one thing. So maybe you're drinking a lot of soda. Eliminating soda, maybe swapping that for say a seltzer, or you still get the fizzy effect. That's a big thing. It's a small thing, but it has a big impact. And maybe then that may be enough, but maybe cut one, add one more thing. Maybe add an extra serving of vegetables to your dinner. That would be cut one, add one. I always and also thinking if you think about the grocery store when you're going shopping, trying to stay out to the outer rim, the perimeter of the grocery store, because foods there are perishable. They're generally, not exclusively, you still have to pay attention. I walked by the other day and there was some bacon that had I think it was Captain Crunch bacon or something. It's that. No, I don't.
Captain Crunch bacon.
I don't think that's a thing. I don't think that should be right. So you do still have. You just can't trust that everything out there is going to be great. But it's more likely than the more I go in, the more
ultra-processed labels, foods, ultra-processed, more salt, more sugar. Yeah, the exterior of the grocery store is going to have more unprocessed foods. Right, fresh whole foods. That's what you want. What you had told me, this one, and this stuck with me, this Michael Pollan, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. I love how simple that is. I might say eat whole foods.
Exactly.
Right? Instead of ultra processed food, just as a minor modification. But I thought that was a really good one. You hear a number of nutritionists, nutritional psychiatrists talk about color, that essentially color in food is a signal of micronutrients, macronutrients,
diversity.
Right? And you want to, if you're making, let's say, a fruit salad or a vegetable salad, more color actually means more variety of nutrients, and your body needs all of those things. So that's like a simple...
And when we're saying body, that's also your microbiome needs that diversity
as well.
Your brain's
part of your body, right?
It's all a system.
Yes, it's all a system. But that one helps me on it. Like if I look at my plate and everything on it is brown.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, maybe I should add some color here, right? Not artificial color.
Also just remember, like, food is awesome. It should be, like, when we see people stop a given dietary protocol, it's often because they just don't enjoy it. So finding a healthy version of something you enjoy, foods you enjoy, is going to help you stick with it longer.
Csikszentmihalyi, who is a very famous psychologist, he's just done a lot of really groundbreaking work on happiness and flow. You may have heard of his research on flow, but he's used this approach called an experience sampling technique, where essentially people are just, you know, you just buzz someone randomly throughout the day and they ask or answer a few simple questions. What are you doing? And then, you know, answer simple questions about your mood. And first on that list, like what makes people happiest? Time with friends, number one. Number two, eating. Eating is literally one of the happiest moments of our lives, right? So we don't want you to take all the joy out of it, right? If I think of the takeaways, big picture takeaways, because there's a lot. Like, we read so much preparing for this podcast, and I totally geeked out. I loved it.
Right, yeah.
I'm curious as to, like, what are your big picture takeaways? Right? This is part of why I've loved teaching the class that you and I teach, and then doing this podcast, is that it constantly gets me to reflect and make these minor changes. So,
and I think, you know, you and I both are lifelong tinkerers.
Yeah.
And so, like, this has made me want to just, and I've used, like, an intermittent fasting in a variety of different ways throughout my life. I haven't, like, this past year, really. I've used a fasting mimicking protocol promoted by Dr. Walter Longo. You can research that as well. It's a 5-day protocol. But I'm interested in, like, let me go back, try adding in a different kind of fasting protocol just to see what that might do now. And, you know, remembering, too, that it's okay to tinker. It's okay to play, and that we change. That we are not the same body. You don't step into the same river twice, right? We are bodies in constant change. So something that maybe didn't work 5 years ago might work now. Something that did work 5 years ago might not work now. So what about you, Phil?
Gosh, there were a number of big ones.
You know, there's so many things.
There's so many things. One of the big ones for me was just, like, I didn't fully appreciate how much energy went into just status quo, basic metabolic function. Like, the brain at rest consumes 20% of your body's energy. That's amazing. And so it did make me more conscious about, you know, again, like, not eating before bed, because my brain needs that energy to flush. One of my takeaways is that little things add up over a lifetime. At 51, right? I want to be conscious of that.
Sure.
Another big one, the Mediterranean diet, for me, is where it's at personally, right? There's so much research on the Mediterranean diet that, like, you know, I knew there was a lot of research supporting it. I guess I didn't realize how robust it was until I really dove into the literature for this. Avoid ultra-processed foods like the plague.
Yeah.
The research in general says just don't eat ultra-processed foods. And, you know, and this is a big one. If I could recommend one book for people to read, not just because they might have depression, but certainly people in my life who I love and who have depression or struggle with depression, anxiety, but also anyone who just, like, well, I want to improve my health and my brain health and be happier in general, thrive, right? I want to be more thriving more. It would be to read the book by Drew Ramsey. He's on the faculty at Columbia University. He's a psychiatrist. The book is called Eat to Beat Depression and Anxiety. And he covers a whole lot of the research, some of which we've covered here, right? He talks about the SMILES trials, right? So reading that book just gives you a really good big overview of what do we know, kind of what's a science-based approach to improving your well-being through diet that's really evidence-based. So that would be
moving to the top of my book list.
Good.
That one. That is it for this episode. Please, my friends, subscribe to the Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcast, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or a question on YouTube, and we will be sure to respond. And be sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook. If you have any questions or comments, or there's a subject you'd like to hear us discuss, please reach out to ThriveologyLab@gmail.com. Thrive on, my friends.
Thrive on.